The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
All right, good afternoon, everybody. What do you call a busload of lawyers driving off a cliff? A good start. Okay, now that I got that out of the way. So people will have seen the pictures and the stories of kids and toddlers in immigration court being deported with no lawyer. We have a million examples of all the ways that the rule of law and equality in bourgeois society is a joke. One of the things that we need to do as Marxists is move from denouncing these horrible things that happen to creating a coherent theory to criticize them and react to them and think about ways to do things differently. And so that's what I want to try to get to today. One of the reasons that this is necessary is that the Trump era has thrown up all sorts of urgent questions about the law, the rule of law, our relationship to the courts, and so on. From the very first day after the airport protests in reaction to the Muslim ban, there's been this issue of litigation, the courts, how should our social movements relate to them? In spring of 2017, Anthony Romero, the executive director of the ACLU, gave an interview to the New York Times in which he said, quote, "I'd like to have 500 lawyers nationwide by 2019. That's bigger than we've ever been. But let's not lose sight of reality. There are 11,000 lawyers in the Department of Justice. 11,000. The power of the federal government can't be overestimated." It seems like Romero wants to like see this battle be waged out by two groups of lawyers, and he's like raising his army to go to the court with the White House. So is that what we think is going to beat back the Trump machine? Recently, this question has been raised again with the announced resignation of Anthony Kennedy, a justice on the Supreme Court. I work at the ACLU, and my coworkers have been asking questions, not really asking questions, saying straight up, we're doomed for decades, we're going to be facing decades of defeats, and we have to be able to say either, yeah, that's true, or no, that's not true, and here's why. And on the flip side, there's a question going around the left, and I think an attitude that the bourgeois courts are where social movements go to die. And I think that's also something we have to grapple with. If we do want to have some relationship to the courts, what should that be? So to answer these questions, we need history and theory. And I don't think that the ISO and the revolutionary left in general yet has a coherent theory of the law. So I'm going to start by pulling together what Marx and others have said and draw some initial theoretical conclusions. I'll start by asking, what is the law? And I'll compare two speeches, one by a bourgeois revolutionary who dealt with the law, and the other by Marx himself. I'll compare and contrast what they say, what Marx says, and what theory of law we might draw out of him to the theory of the state. They seem similar. I'll make an argument that contracts under capitalism are separate from the state, that kind of function as a form of law outside of it, and then consider some counter-arguments to that position. Finally, I'll deal with law and the relationship to the law of working class movements and movements of the oppressed, and then talk about what law might look like under working class power, under a working class state, and then naturally think about what, in the transition to a classless society that Marx talked about, what law might look like. This theoretical space is wide open. Like I said, I don't think there is like any given wisdom on this. So during the discussion, people should feel free to ask any question that you might have. People always say no question is too stupid. That's like especially true here. Like there is no received wisdom. We need to get everything out. If something I say isn't answered or something I say is unclear, asking the question will help all of us clarify things moving forward. So challenge any links I draw and so on. Okay, so what is the law? When people talk about law, what comes to mind might be the courts, the role of judges, law enforcement, meaning the police. A lot of people might think of the new Jim Crow, the kind of model of the racist legal system that Michelle Alexander has outlined. So in general, it seems like the state might be a good stand-in for the law. Like I said, later I'm going to try to develop a pushback on this and think about the role of contracts as a relationship between private individuals. A more general theory of law might be rules of conduct in society that regulate the way people interact, and they're codified in some way. That raises the question of where do these laws come from? A lot of bourgeois theory on this starts with the ideas of the Enlightenment. So people, you know, even if you haven't read them, you'll be familiar from government class in school about John Locke, Thomas Hobbes. You know, we all come out of the state of nature, and individuals form a social contract together to better themselves and others. The basic problem with this theory is that in history, we've seen that societies change. And with those changes, new laws come about and new laws are codified. By looking at that process, the process by which societies change and then laws change, we can try to see the ways that law came about. So in 1804, 12 years into the new French Republic, the Code Napoléon was enacted. This was the first time in world history that there was, on a national scale, a code regulating civil law, meaning the way that individuals interact. This code spread throughout much of the world. The US and other countries went along a slightly different line following English common law, but they all had various similarities, again following from those ideas of the Enlightenment. The French jurist introducing it, as Michael Tiger, a historian, recounts, quote, set out the official version of the French bourgeoisie's struggle for power. So here's what that jurist said. Quote, it was our discoveries in the arts, our first successes in navigation, and the ferment happily born of our successes that produced the law of waterways and forests, the regulation of commerce, and that of maritime trade. There were judicial reforms, civil procedure was corrected, a new order was established in criminal justice, and the vast project of giving a uniform code to France was conceived. Those who attempted the code met insurmountable obstacles, and he lists these out, including the rivalries of power, attachment of people to customs, and of course, quote, the superstitious disbelief of lawyers in the utility of any change which would affect that which they had laboriously learned and practiced for all their lives. He says now people are, quote, evaluating legislative proposals in the light of reason and experience and studying them in their relationship to the rights of man and to the needs of society. Railing against feudalism, he says, quote, institutions seemingly unshakable crumbled. They were without roots in the sentiments of the people. Power found itself quickly conquered by opinion. But he also mentions, and he's probably referring to the 1789 National Assembly decree abolishing feudalism, but also promising land redistribution. He says, quote, to suppress the odious system of privilege and preference and to prevent its rebirth, some sought to level all fortunes after having leveled all social ranks. But more moderate ideas came back to the fore, the first laws were corrected, new plans demanded. It was understood that a civil code must be prepared with wisdom and not imposed with fury and haste. So go forward 40 years and move to Germany. Karl Marx and Frederick Engels are on trial as co-editors of their paper, which I'll abbreviate as the NRZ because I'm not going to try to pronounce it. There, at this time in Europe and in Germany, there are ongoing bourgeois revolutions and counter-revolutions by the feudal lords, the nobles, and the crown. So the bourgeois national assembly in Germany passed a law basically saying don't pay taxes to the crown. It's an illegitimate government, it's authoritarian, and so on. The crown slams this and threatens to prosecute anyone who follows it. The NRZ reprints a statement by a local democratic party saying don't pay the taxes and in fact organize resistance to this illegitimate government. The Crown prosecutes the paper and Marx and Engels. It uses a law passed in 1848, and it was passed not by the bourgeois National Assembly, but with its consent. It was passed by what was basically the feudal lords' national assembly called the Diet. This basically said that, this was a law passed in 1848, which set up a reconciliation government between the bourgeoisie and the feudal lords, and, when you set up a government that includes paying taxes, and so the crown says you're violating this law, we're going to prosecute you. The problem is that months after that law was passed in 1848 and before the prosecution began, the crown unilaterally imposed a new constitution on the whole country, meaning that laws that came before it were obviously illegitimate. So Marx is speaking before the jury, laying all this out, saying this doesn't make any sense that they're using an old law that the crown has basically overthrown. And as he's speaking, he's holding the Code of Napoleon up to make a point about the role of law in society. He says that even if the crown had not overthrown this previous law, it was total BS because it was a concession to the old feudal lords whose role in society had become obsolete with the rise of the bourgeoisie. It was an extra legal concession to the Diet to, quote, preserve a semblance of legal continuity and help the old feudal lords trudge on. In this time, social stability was being trashed by the old and new ruling classes as they fought back and forth amongst each other. And in the midst of this, if people tried to use the new democratic rights they'd won through the course of revolution, they would be prosecuted for violating what Marx and others called, quote, the legal basis of society, or what we might think about as the rule of law. So Marx asked the jury, how is the old feudal Diet allowed to, quote, dictate laws to the new society which asserted its rights through the revolution? And he answers, quote, to maintain laws belonging to a bygone social era and framed by representatives of vanished or vanishing social interests who consequently give the force of law only to those interests which run counter to the public needs. Society is not founded upon the law. This is a legal fiction. On the contrary, the law must be founded upon society. It must express the common interests and needs of society, which arise from the material mode of production prevailing at the given time. This Code Napoleon, which I am holding in my hand, has not created modern bourgeois society. On the contrary, bourgeois society, which emerged in the 18th century and developed further in the 19th, merely finds its legal expression in this code. As soon as it ceases to fit the social conditions, it simply becomes a bundle of paper. So he was pretty convincing, and the jury acquitted them. Now, you'll notice that in what Marx says, there is actually some basic agreement with what the French jurist said with the ideas of the Enlightenment. They both talk about expressing the law, expressing the common interests and needs of society. But Marx adds two critical points. Number one, these interests, quote, arise from the material mode of production. And number two, this mode of production is the one, quote, prevailing at the given time. So what does this mean? First, if production is class-based, then so will the law, and the laws will reflect the particular character of the class relation in society. Number two, it means that if a class successfully revolts, the law will change, and it will change according to the new mode of production which is instituted, and that may or may not be class-based. This is the Marxist theory of law. So this sounds pretty similar to the theory of the state, and there's, you know, there's other talks happening on this where we, you know, that will come out more. But I mean, if you just think about, like, the way we talk about law in our democratic society is that the legislature writes the law and passes it, the executive implements it, and the judiciary interprets it and allows the law to be applied. We talk about how the state maintains the rule of law. Again, Marxists, I think, in a very core sense, actually agree with this, insofar as this is class law, that is what is ruling over society. Most of us here probably think of the new Jim Crow as a really good metaphor for the legal system. Frederick Engels, commenting on the resistance of English workers to military tax on their strikes, says this, and I think the linking of the law and state in this comment is pretty apparent. He says, quote, "Certainly the law is sacred to the bourgeois, for it is of his making, put through with his approval and for his protection and benefit. He knows that even if a particular law may injure him as an individual, still the complex of legislation as a whole protects his interests, and that above all, the strongest support of his social position is the sanctity of the law and the inviolability of the order established by the active expression of will by one part of society and passive acceptance by the other. It is because the English bourgeois sees his own image in the law as he does in his God that he holds it to be holy, and that the policeman's club, which is really his own club, holds a power for him that is wonderfully reassuring. But for the worker, it certainly does not. The worker knows only too well and from too long experience that the law is a rod which the bourgeois holds over his head, and he does not bother himself about it unless he has to. Since the workers do not respect the law, but simply submit to its power when they cannot change it, it is most natural that they should at least propose alterations in it, that they should wish to put a proletarian law in the place of the legal fabric of the bourgeoisie." And he goes on to describe what this proletarian law might look like, describing the working class Chartist movement for parliamentary reform in England. And this is important for both Marxist theories of law and the state. They're mediators of class conflict, and the workers can influence them, even in bourgeois society. But here is what the equation of law and the state leaves out. The particular character of the mode of production under capitalism, which Marx mentioned earlier, ends up meaning that the law and the state do not fully map on. This is unlike previous class societies. Under feudalism, the serf was economically exploited by the noble, who was also his political and religious master. The reason the noble was superior is because God said he was. The serf's exploitation is tied up with his political subjugation to his exploiter. Under capitalism, it's different. As Marx says, quote, "The worker and the owner of money meet in the market and deal with each other as on the basis of equal rights. With this difference alone, one is the buyer and one is the seller, both therefore equal in the eyes of the law." This is in Marx's book, Capital, which accepts the framework that the Enlightenment philosophers and economists put out, that capitalism is generalized commodity exchange, where everyone meets in the market, we're all equal, we all sell goods, workers sell their labor power and are hired by the boss. What he shows is that exploitation happens despite the legal equality, despite the absence of political domination by the state. But here's the question. If it's not the state's law which regulates this exchange, this relationship between two commodity owners, one the owner of labor power, the other one who's buying it, what does regulate that? Marx again gives the answer in Capital. Quote, this juridical relation, which thus expresses itself in a contract, whether such contract be part of a developed legal system or not, it is a relation between two wills, one the worker, one the boss, and is but the reflex of the real economic relation between the two. So this is a contribution that I want to make, that the contract is the unique law of the capitalist mode of production. And because of its place at the point of production, it is a prototype for the rest of law under capitalism, including the state's law. So the point that Marx makes is that under capitalism, at least accepting the Enlightenment framework, we're all equals, we're all legal subjects, we're all legal persons. So that's why the state establishes the rule of law, right? That's the thing which applies to all people equally. We all have to follow the law. That only follows from the mode of production in which we all start out as equals. This is why Evgeny Pashinkanis, who is a Bolshevik, a Russian Marxist legal theorist, says that the statutory form, the statute which the state passes, we shouldn't take that as our starting point, but instead see that as a particular case. So, like I said, I think when most leftists think of the law, we think of the criminal justice system or the criminal injustice system, we think of the new Jim Crow. I actually would say that we should see that as following from this basic form of law, which comes out of the contract, which comes out of commodity exchange. So if you think about the concept of individual guilt and individual liability, this follows from the concept of us all being legal subjects who have free will, who participate in the market. Liability in capitalist society and the criminal justice system is broken down. You know, you can be negligent and receive a certain amount of punishment. You can be intentional. You can have premeditated actions. All of these shade the punishment because they're all considered certain bad exercises of our will. And what is the punishment in capitalist society? It's jail. It's a deprivation of freedom. Pashinkanis says, quote, "Deprivation of freedom for a period stipulated in the court sentence is the specific form in which modern, that is to say bourgeois capitalist, criminal law embodies the principle of equivalent recompense. This form is unconsciously yet deeply linked with the conception of abstract human labor measurable in time." The idea being that if you break the rules of the market, you break the rules of the commodity exchange game, you're taken out of that, put in jail, you serve a sentence, and then you're allowed back into the market, you're allowed back into capitalist society. Okay, so you might be like, all right, okay, maybe the contract is a relationship between two private people, but if a contract is broken, what happens? You go to the state, and the state enforces it, the state puts someone in jail. There's a step in between, though, which is that you go to the courts first. The courts rule on the issue and then direct the state to enforce it or not. And that's because in bourgeois society, courts are seen as kind of like a superhuman meta thing that exists on an upper layer which interprets and enforces, or directs the state to enforce law. Pashinkanis points out that in the constitutional state, like the one we live under, the judiciary has the power to rule on whether the actions of the executive branch and the legislative branch are constitutional. And if they're not, then they say this isn't allowed. So courts occupy the place of law, which in some sense comes before the state. If you think about a civil case, like say me and Kyle, or I sue Kyle for something, we go to the judge and the judge says, as an impartial third party, okay, here's who wins. But this is true even in a criminal case, right? If I'm being prosecuted for a crime, I'm the defendant, the prosecutor represents the state, but the judge is still considered to be a neutral third party. They're not considered to be part of the state in that milieu. Okay, so this is all I think follows from the framework that Marx sets out. One really basic objection that can be made is that, no, dude, actually, we do have real inequalities in our society. People are legally subjugated. The state does actually impose a lower status on people. I mean, there's all sorts of examples we can give of this, going back all the way to the beginning of bourgeois society, where indigenous people were murdered, were thrown off their land, land was not redistributed so that everybody was equal. Women, for most of bourgeois society, have not even been considered legal persons. They could not own property, they could not make decisions for themselves. And the example I gave at the very beginning, I mean, how in any way is the court acting as a neutral third party when it's deporting immigrants, little, you know, toddlers who don't have lawyers? This is because the bourgeoisie uses the state as basically a battering ram against the working class. Everything else will be subordinated to that when necessary, including the rule of law in the courts. Pashinkanis puts it this way, quote, "The sharper and more bitter the class struggle, the more difficult it will be for class rule to be realized within the legal form. When that happens, the impartial court and its legal guarantees will be ousted by an organization of unmediated class violence with methods guided by considerations of political expediency alone. The bourgeoisie routinely distorts law to fit its needs. This is most obvious in the American case in the way the ruling class has distorted the law to legally subjugate first African slaves and then later, through the course of that, black people. English law actually forbids slavery, so colonial Virginia had to improvise a new legal structure to basically allow them to use slaves. This legal disenfranchisement of African slaves was extended to inheritance, so that the child of a white master and a black slave woman would not be the master's heir. The Virginia State Assembly passed a law saying that slaves should be thought of not as legal persons, but as chattel, as farm animals. And that's the basis of the phrase chattel slavery, is that was a legal change that had to happen to make sure that slaves could not inherit property. In 1857, when the Supreme Court ruled in the Dred Scott case, they said that black people could not be legal persons and didn't have, quote unquote, standing, therefore, to sue in court for their freedom. Sometimes there was no legal theory behind, it just didn't make any sense. If you look at the three-fifths clause in the Constitution, this was a totally arbitrary political dividing up of what a black person's legal worth was in terms of the voting system, which was just very literally a political calculation. There was no legal justification whatsoever. Michelle Alexander, in her book, points out how the mass use of the category of felon, of labeling people as felons, basically functions as a colorblind update to legal subjugation of black people. And it also points out how, before I had talked about how criminal law functions as a way of removing individual people from the market, they serve their sentence and then they're allowed back into the commodity exchange game. Michelle Alexander points out that that's not true. Criminal law has restructured whole swaths of society, whole like groups of people, whole cities have been destroyed by the removal of black people, put into prisons, and then when they get out, they're labeled as criminals for the rest of their lives. So how do we deal with this? Marx, this is something that I've also grappled with a lot. How do we make sense of the fact that in Capital, Marx kind of sets out this framework of commodity exchange where people are equal, yet in reality, they really don't seem to be under capitalism? One way of understanding this is that he was making a critique of Enlightenment political economy, that even if we agree with what you're saying, that everyone's equal, and even in situations where capitalism does have that as a formally equal market, exploitation will still happen. But he also clearly saw something essential in that relationship, in the wage-labor relationship of capitalism. I'm not going to try to fully reconcile that, but I mean, because that's something that I'm still thinking about, and I hope it's something that if you have thoughts on, you can raise that during the discussion. Okay, so keeping all of that in mind, keeping in mind the structure and theory and history of bourgeois law, how should working class movements relate to it? We fight for reforms in law not based on some working class legal theory, but on the basis of our politics. And any radical legal theory that we develop should come out of that. In 1864, Marx praised the 30-year successful fight of the English working class to compel Parliament to pass the 10 Hours Act, which basically set that as the limit for the working day for women and children in factories. And then later, struggles of the working class advanced that for everybody. Marx said this was, quote, a great contest between the blind rule of the supply and demand laws, which form the political economy of the middle class, and social production controlled by social foresight, which forms the political economy of the working class. Hence, the 10 Hours Bill was not only a great practical success, it was the victory of a principle. So there we can begin to see, he talks about the political economy of the working class, we can begin to see how through the course of struggle, we develop principles around human rights, around what he calls social production controlled by social foresight. I want to give two other historical examples that I think are important for our moment. One has to do with the resignation of Anthony Kennedy, the fear that Donald Trump is going to appoint a new conservative justice and we're going to be doomed to decades of defeats. In 1973, Roe v. Wade was passed down by the Supreme Court, creating the constitutional right to abortion. This happened after President Nixon, that conservative anti-choice bigot, appointed four justices to the Supreme Court, replacing the great liberal Earl Warren, who's kind of heralded as the person who brought the civil rights rulings of the court. One of the justices that Nixon appointed wrote the decision of Roe v. Wade, and two of them joined it. And this is because the women's liberation movement forced the right to choose and forced a recognition of that on legal institutions, and a new constitutional right was created out of nowhere. Another example, which I think is germane to the discussions about the role of labor and the strategy for labor after the Janus decision. In the 1930s, the Supreme Court was repeatedly striking down the legislation of the New Deal because it impeded on the freedom of contract and violated the Commerce Clause, which is a part of the Constitution which basically says the federal government can only regulate what's called interstate commerce. So it was repeatedly striking down New Deal legislation. You might, you know, have heard like that Roosevelt was going to pack the court to like put in new liberal justices to make sure they would pass this, not strike down this legislation and so on. But in 1937, they upheld the Wagner Act, which was created the National Labor Relations Board. Yeah, sorry, acronyms are always the thing that I go to. And they upheld this as it applied to interstate businesses, which was kind of expected, plus major steel companies, which employed to the extent of 22,000 people. And they said it was, quote, necessary to protect interstate commerce from the paralyzing consequences of industrial war. Industrial war was referring to the militant labor movement at the time, which was carrying out hundreds of sit-down strikes, shutting down whole factories, and really paralyzing the economy on the, you know, with the power of workers and saying that you will concede to our political demands or we will stop working. And the Supreme Court made a concession to this by saying, okay, I mean, with these huge steel companies being shut down, especially, you know, as production was ramping up for the Second World War, they made a concession to that. But they went one step further, which is that there were two other cases before the court which had to do with tiny manufacturing companies which employed less than 1,000 people. And they said that the Wagner Act even applied to those companies, and therefore even workers at those companies had the right to form a union. There was no argument made about how that was interstate commerce, what that had to do with that at all. And in fact, the court didn't include any legal reasoning in those cases. It just said, see our previous cases on the interstate businesses and on the steel companies. So why is this? It's because at the time, the median sit-down strike only involved 100 workers. And that was the threat that the Supreme Court was facing. And that's the threat that the whole country was, I mean, the ruling class of the country was looking at. So even these small companies were being racked by sit-down strikes, and the Supreme Court made a very obviously political concession to this fight of the workers. So those, I think, are some examples of when working class movements in the past have, through their fight, forced and bended ruling class legal institutions to their will. So keeping those in mind and keeping the principles in mind that developed through the course of those struggles, what might law look like under working class power? I'm going to give the example of the court system that developed after the Russian Revolution and then draw some theoretical conclusions out of this. Just to say there's all sorts of examples that we can look to and that we should look to. This is something that I'm doing more research on, and if you know people who are familiar with other revolutionary situations should definitely bring up other examples. And the role of the courts, I think, during a revolutionary period is very important. But you know, the role of the state in general is informed by the structure of law. It's just useful, I think, because I don't think this is often, this isn't a history that we often discuss, the courts specifically. So one participant in the revolution describes what happened in his village after the Bolsheviks and the Soviets took power. He talks about how the police were all arrested. The local Soviet was elected, but at the time there wasn't actually an official court set up. Quote, as the first step, one had to take a look at the judicial legacy of the autocratic regime. There were heaps of unfinished cases that had accumulated over the years. More than 100 of the pending cases involved either peasants caught cutting wood in the count's 7,000-acre forest or damage done by their cattle to his 1,000 acres of meadows. I glanced at these cases and thought, well, the count is no more. Who will press these matters? So I picked up that pile and shoved it into the stove. So the Soviet became aware of all sorts of complaints of rowdyism, of theft. One of the things that they heard was that a group of former soldiers under the Tsar were getting drunk and harassing people. They were called before the Soviet, but the former soldiers refused to recognize the authority of the court. Quote, but when the chairman of the court explained that all power had been vested in the local Soviets and that offenses of this kind were not to be left unpunished, and, moreover, drew their attention to the presence of the Red Guard detachment, the accused submitted to the jurisdiction of the court. After questioning the accused and the witnesses, the court sentenced each of the former to deprivation of freedom for 2 weeks. They were to begin to serve their term immediately. Long resounded the applause of workers and peasants in attendance. So these were courts that the local Soviets, and this happened across Russia, the local Soviets set up and kind of took up the immediate legal cases and complaints of robbery and theft, of violence and so on, in the month following the overthrowing of the provisional government. A month into the revolution, the first national decree on courts was set out and abolished all of the old courts, set rules for how the Soviets should elect judges, and it also created the position of the people's assessor, which was basically a lay judge that was selected, you know, that explicitly was supposed to rotate among people so that everyone could get practice establishing and running the court system. All of these positions were recallable. They were all supposed to be based on the either a democratic election by the Soviet or a democratic election directly from the people. At this time, there were no set procedures or code, and people were basically expected to develop this themselves, right? There wasn't an attempt to say, this is the way that certain crimes will be punished, these are the exact procedures that courts will use, and so on. This was something that was debated among the Bolshevik Party and other people who were in the Council of People's Commissars and other bodies that were developing new theories of law. Do we need procedural protections? Should we make sure to keep those in place? In order to keep those in place, do we have to retain the old lawyers, you know, people who were trained under the Tsar, who kind of are attached to those way of doing things? There were other decrees that went back and forth over the following months, either creating new appellate courts and a new court structure or doing away with those. A year into the revolution, the People's Court Act was passed. This forbid all references to the old code, the old kind of laws that were in place under the Tsar, and then later under the rule of the bourgeoisie. A national bar was created of educated lawyers in order to help give legal help to people and start thinking through some of these problems. And then it did establish certain panels of judges and lay judges for certain crimes. So saying the more serious crimes should have a lay at a panel of judges, the less serious crimes or less serious disputes, people can have more leeway in terms of how they deal with those. And all of these were still to be elected by the Soviet, and all of these were still to be immediately recallable. An example of one case might be instructive. A 15-year-old was at a train station, and as this is recounted, he was waiting for a train. He later went away, apparently, to smell some flowers. I'm kind of skeptical that that was the actual reason. And then the train came in, picked people up, and started leaving, and so he starts running to catch up. Which is why, like, sure, you're going to smell flowers, come on. So anyway, he's running to catch up to the train, he jumps on, grabs the handle, and the conductor of the train hits him on the chest, he flies off, and the wheel of the train crushes his leg. I just want to say as a side note, like, this is something that I see in law school all the time. It's like a hypothetical that we then look at. And so it's just kind of amazing to see this in real life during the revolution and see how they dealt with it. So at trial, the railway said, we need more evidence to show whether or not this person can work, because if he can work, what's the big deal? We'll pay some minor damages. The judges said no. He's very clearly in shock. They had medical evidence showing that he would be unable to work. And they ordered the railway to pay support wages for the rest of the life of this boy, or until a social insurance system was established that could take care of him. So the courts, these courts continued to handle local disputes for a couple years. In 1919, of the 61,000 judgments of non-political crimes that they handed down, 43% were acquitted, 35% were imprisoned, and most of these were probation. And then there were other punishments, most tellingly labor, but without imprisonment. So people would be expected to work, keeping in mind this is in the middle of a famine, in the middle of a civil war, where food and so on were in short supply. 75% of the cases were property related. And it's worth keeping in mind too, in 1923 it was estimated that 76% of the people's judges were workers and peasants. So I mentioned that these courts handled non-political crimes. Political crimes like treason were handled by higher courts. And these also had a near half acquittal rate and generally sentenced the vast majority of people who were found guilty to jail, but did sentence a minority to death. There were all sorts of progressive changes made in the court system, especially coming out of the Tsarist period, like ending the use of courts in jail for children, raising the minimum age of criminal liability, because under the czar you could be liable even if you were like 10 or 11. Like I said, I think there's a lot more research to be done on this. This isn't something that the role of the courts after the during the revolutionary period hasn't been really looked into. Sam Farber, who wrote a book chapter on socialist legality, he'll be speaking on a later panel on the Bolsheviks in power, was very critical of the role of the Bolsheviks and their attitude towards law. He recommends actually, rather than looking at the courts for good examples, looking at the rules that local factory committees made in terms of regulating the workplace and running, running workplace decisions. One of the things that he talks about is that at the end of 1917, the war industries were, their production was declining. And some Petrograd factory committees agreed on certain sets of principles for how people should be made redundant, basically meaning which workers should be let go and which should be allowed to continue working and earning. So one example he gives from the rule set up by a factory committee, quote, workers should be made redundant in the following order. First to go would be volunteers, second merchants, traders, yard keepers, caretakers, and others who had entered the factory in order to avoid conscription. Third, those who had refused to join a trade union. Fourth, members of families in which more than one member worked at the factory. Fifth, youth under the age of 18, unless they had dependents or were without families. Sixth, those with some property or element of fixed income. Seventh, those from families in which other members were still employed, though not at the factory. Eighth, single people with no dependents. Ninth and last to go would be workers with dependents according to the number of dependents they had. So looking at all of the examples, we can try to draw some conclusions about what law looks like. What is workers' law when they're in power? I actually think in this case it is very closely related to the workers, to the theory of the workers' state. Because unlike capitalism, where there is a certain division of the political and economic, under the workers' state there isn't. In fact, the idea is that workers as a whole should democratically control production, and the state should be a democratic whole of the workers. So there's two points that I think are both backed up by the evidence that we just talked about from the courts. Number one is the maximization of democracy and a use of what Marx referred to as the political economy of the working class. Talking about the Paris Commune, for example, Marx said that the assembly, quote, was to be a working, not parliamentary body, executive and legislative at the same time. And keeping in mind the bourgeoisie's ultimate contempt for the rule of law, like I said, they're willing to disregard it when they need to with the use of the state, Marx praised that the judiciary in the commune was, quote, divested of that sham independence which had but served to mask their abject subserviency to all succeeding governments, and, quote, like the rest of public servants, magistrates and judges were to be elected, responsible and revocable. Lenin, discussing the workers' state, said that it is the power it has is essentially the same as the Paris Commune, and that power is, quote, and sorry, he says the, quote, the source of power is not a law previously discussed and enacted by Parliament, but the direct initiative of the people from below in their local areas, and he's talking about the Soviets. Sam Farber, in thinking about the rules that factory committee laid out, points out that these weren't based on party membership, but on working class principles like union membership and the rejection of bourgeois draft evaders. And again, I think that like Sam is someone, I'm sorry he's not here because he could then talk more about this, but he's someone who has a different take on the Russian Revolution than many of us, and I really recommend that people go to that panel so we can talk about some of this stuff. So one of the things that I don't fully have time to get into, but I do want to mention, is that the goal of the worker state and the goal of socialism is to do away with class divisions and to establish what, you know, shorthand we call communism, but the idea of a classless society, one in which production is not based on class relations, but one in which people work in order to have experiences, where work is something that we strive to do, not something that we dread. So this is harder to back up with the evidence that I gave, simply because the Russian Revolution was not successful, because it did succumb to bureaucratization and centralization, and I think that's something that has to be studied more. One of the goals of the worker state is to smash the bourgeoisie and to get rid of the old bourgeois state. And this is why, I mean, for example, the person who threw the old cases into the fire, this is something that has to be done. You have to get rid of all of the old biases, all of the old punishments, all of the unfair, oppressive laws that existed before. But also through the course of the revolution, social relations aren't just magically gonna go away. They're going to last, there's gonna be some holdover. what Marx referred to as the birth pangs of communism as it comes out of capitalism. So this explains why the 15-year-old whose leg was crushed by the train got money damages, right? Property and money is still important. This also explains why 75% of the cases that the courts handled had to do with property. It explains why people weren't expected to just simply submit to the jurisdiction of the courts, but the Red Guard actually had to be there to make people do that and to make people follow the rulings. Again, social relations don't change magically. But as Lenin and Marx and others outlined, we do seek to see the withering away of the state as the mediator of class conflict as classes begin to dissolve. Pashukanis puts it this way, quote, "The withering away of law and with it of the state ensues, in Marx's view, only after labor has become not only a means of life, but life's prime want." So in any society, there's still going to be conflict. There's still going to be problems between people that are going to have to be resolved. The question is, do we still need the coercive form of the law? Do we still need the courts? Do we still need the criminal justice system and so on? And I think the answer is no. And I'm going to give Pashukanis the last word on this. Quote, "Even progressive bourgeois criminology has become convinced that the prevention of crime may properly be viewed as a medical educational problem. To solve this problem, jurists, with their evidence, their codes, their concepts of guilt and of full or diminished responsibility, or their fine distinction between complicity, aiding and abetting, instigation, and so on, are entirely superfluous. And the only reason this theoretical conviction has not yet led to the abolition of penal codes and the criminal courts is, of course, that the overthrow of the legal form is dependent not only on transcending the framework of bourgeois society, but also on a radical emancipation from all its remnants."
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.